Welcome to the Future Work Playbook. This podcast series features founders, investors, and legal talent that will help you embrace technology and transform your organization for a better future. This series is hosted by Natalie Pierce, the chair of Gunderson Dettmer's Labor and Employment Law Practice. Natalie and her guests are committed to helping you develop new playbooks to elevate your game.
Hi, welcome to Season 6 of Future Work Playbook, where we explore how innovative companies are reshaping the way we work. I'm Natalie Pierce. Today's episode features Gabe Duncan's remarkable journey from jazz guitar to AI. Gabe is co-founder and CTO of Slang.ai, which is revolutionizing how restaurants communicate with their customers. Slang.ai was honored by Fast Company this year as one of the most innovative companies, and is now partnering with OpenTable. Slang.ai is transforming customer service through AI with a uniquely human touch. Their ambitious mission? To save a billion minutes by 2030 by freeing both restaurant staff and customers from routine communications, allowing more time for what matters most, genuine human connection. Gabe's story shows us how diverse experiences can spark groundbreaking innovation. Let's dive in. Welcome, Gabe.
Thank you. Thanks, Natalie, and thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Can you share your elevator pitch for those who are not familiar with Slang.ai?
So Slang, it's been evolving over time, so I'll give you the latest elevator pitch. But what Slang is doing today is creating a unified communications platform for restaurants, driven by AI. So we started out mostly just focusing on voice and phone because that was the hardest use case for us to nail. And now we're starting expanding into multimodal use cases like SMS, Instagram messaging, and a whole host of other communications platforms. And the idea is to sort of be the central nervous system of communications for a restaurant that has unique insights and data for them and can handle as many end-to-end use cases as possible.
Fantastic. I read an ambitious, but I think achievable goal of yours is to save a billion minutes by 2030. Do you recall that?
we put that together a long, long time ago. But yeah, that is true. So the way we thought about that was, we wanted to save both the people guests and diners interacting with restaurants a lot of their time, and also restaurant operators, hosts, the people in the restaurant generally, as much time as possible there. And we've kind of evolved this to shift more towards increasing revenue and capturing revenue. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit more finance focused, but that is still one of our kind of loftier, less tactical goals. We would like to give everybody their time back to do other things. Born out of one insight we had early on when we watched people interact with humans versus, you know, the prototypical AI, I would say, before it's gotten as advanced as it is today, because we've been around for almost 5.5 years. So we predated LLMs and all of that stuff. We saw that people would speak more, I guess, fluidly and less in a less focused manner with humans than they would with machines, which led us to believe that there's some middle ground between talking to a human and sort of like kind of verbal, for lack of a better word, kind of vomiting a whole bunch of information to a rep or to a host that is not relevant, and it forces them to sift through it and kind of focus in on the conversation that needs to be had, which is often pretty transactional. And then like a very frustrating experience people might have with something that's, you know, super on rails and constraining, like an IVR system or a really bad AI experience. And so that's kind of how we carved out that mission and vision to save people all that time, is, you know, both create this really great experience that doesn't feel too stilted, but also help it be intelligent enough to focus the conversation in a way that would save time on both ends.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there've been times when all of us have put in a phone call to a restaurant. Maybe we have a question, and maybe it's during busy hours, and it's almost like exasperation on the other end, like, really, you got to hold, you got to wait. And so it, yeah, I just think it is so good for everyone. And I've somewhere I read a quote of a restaurant owner saying, yeah, if I stopped using slang.ai, my staff would boycott because, you know, they were tired of having to arrive and deal with, you know, sometimes dozens of voicemails during a time where you're really just trying to focus on a better customer experience. So Gabe, I think your company is great and rightfully recognized as one of the most innovative companies. I would love your background. It's a really great story. It's a really great background. And I would really like to circle back with you and explore kind of your non-traditional route to becoming a technical founder, if that's okay.
Sure. I'll start in high school. It's sort of relevant. It was a long time ago, unfortunately, but I started out at a high school for visual and performing arts in Houston. It's kind of this really magical place. A lot of Grammy winners have gone there. Beyonce was briefly there before she left for Destiny's Child, and Robert Glasper, who's a very famous jazz musician now. I used to play in jazz band with him and Matthew Mullenweg, who's the founder of Automatic and WordPress. So it's a very special place, very dear to my heart. And I was a jazz guitarist and was very, very disciplined. I mean, I think people who start out in music tend to make very good engineering personalities just because of the discipline it takes to get good at an instrument and the amount of banging your head against the wall you have to do to get anywhere, which is very similar for engineering. And so I started out there in music and started to develop some repetitive stress injuries very young, and ended up when I went to school, I had to chart a different course for myself and decide on doing something that wouldn't involve as much of my small muscle movement on my hands. And so I basically took a break from music and ended up going to Columbia and studying eventually applied math. Kind of fell into applied math because I was originally studying something called science and religion and was always very interested in science. And so this Columbia had spun up this major science and religion, and they kind of abandoned it after a year, and then it just became a religious studies coursework. And I was kind of like, what am I doing here? I'm not going to go into clergy, and I don't think I want to be an academic, so this doesn't really make sense. And I actually took a year off from Columbia and moved home to kind of reevaluate. And in that time, got a job at a neuroscience lab at UT Health Sciences through a friend who was a mathematical biologist that I've known for a long time. And through that job, I got just a lab tech job and was given a task to play with some models that they had built to model salamander and goldfish retinal receptor cells. And I had to kind of learn from my friend who's a mathematical biologist. I mean, I had a pretty strong background in math and was always interested in it. So I wasn't starting from scratch, but he kind of had to teach me some of the math behind it. And I didn't really know what I was doing. And I was tasked with figuring out some problem that seemed really repetitive and boring. And I was like, there's got to be a better way to do this. I just can't sit here in this room all day, like playing with these little parameters on the model that had a lot of parameters to try and figure out which one would actually work. So I called Columbia's math department and was like, I'm a student in the religion department, but I have this problem and I really need help with it. Is there anybody at the math department that would be willing to help? And they put me in touch with this my professor, well, eventually became my professor, Professor Spiegelman, who was kind of the head of the applied mathematics department at Columbia. And he started kind of mentoring me a little bit. And with both of those mentors and some elbow grease, I ended up building a whole automated model exploration system that was flexible enough for them to kind of build their own models and run analyses on them. And I ended up sort of publishing a paper on that. And after college, getting invited by my PI to kind of stay in the academic route. And I was sort of attracted to it, but it seemed very, very minute. Like the focus was very, very small, and that wasn't very attractive to me. So, and I also had a lot of debt built up from Columbia. So my choices were a little bit limited. And so it was also 2008 when I graduated and the economy was on fire. And so I took a job at a startup. The startup eventually failed, but in that time, I kind of started teaching myself how to do web development, learning Python, JavaScript, and some other programming concepts, and started building them tools that they weren't really totally asking for, but I just wanted to kind of get my chops up and sharpen my sword. And at the same time, I started freelancing on the side, building people e-commerce websites, WordPress plugins, like data science consulting, all kinds of stuff. And after a year at that job, my friends who were in a band called Lucius, so it's kind of a callback to the music background. So some of my friends who had moved out to the East Coast and gone to music school were going on tour down to South by Southwest, and they asked me if I wanted to join them as a guitar player because they had kind of moved on from their current guitar player, and they were like, "We need somebody." Yeah, so I was like, "Hell yeah!" I really didn't like that job. Yeah, and I wasn't getting paid a ton of money because it was post economy crash, so it was sort of like an employer's market, and so I just quit my job and literally jumped in a van a couple of days later and went on tour down the East Coast, ended up in Austin for South by Southwest. And that kind of began a 5-year period of me running my own business on the side, doing web consulting. I was doing design, web development. Like I said, data science consulting. Like, I consulted for BuzzFeed when there were only like 10 people at the company.
No way. Wow.
Yeah, they were in like a little tiny room in Chinatown. This was really, really, cheap, dingy office. So it was a really cool experience. And it was great to do music for 5 years. But after 5 years, I was kind of getting burnt out and not really, financially kind of getting nervous. Like, okay, I'm getting into my 30s and this is probably starting to be a bad decision, if not already one.
And at that point, it's no longer an employer's market. You've got real lucrative opportunities out there in the world.
Yes, you're speaking exactly what my inner voice said. So yeah, that was my thought process. And so I ended up getting a job at the New York Times in 2014, actually. Yeah. And I didn't know it at the time, but one of my senior project professor from Columbia actually is the head of data science there. And I ended up finding that out in the interview.
That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah. And my boss's boss then was the one who interviewed and brought me on. She's important later for the next job. But yeah, at the New York Times, it was like an amazing experience. I was there for the 2016 election, which was just a wild, wild time to be at that company.
Wow.
Yeah. Was in the war room where we were watching all the real-time data stream in on the elections as it was happening, and everybody was just like in total disbelief. And
yeah, what's going on?
Yeah, yeah, it was crazy. And then we got to all go downstairs and watch the motorcade come when Trump came to yell at Dean Baquet, who was the head editor. And so it was a super, super special time to be there. And that company was great to me. And I learned everything I know about comp sci and distributed systems, and the more difficult computer science type of problems that I'd never learned because I only studied math. So it was an incredible experience. And my boss's boss, the one who had hired me, ended up going to Spotify, and she kept pinging me, being like, "Hey, it's, you're a musician. You want to do more machine learning and data science again. I know you want that. Like, I can give you a position here. It's way better here than New York Times." And I was like, "Okay, I'll just try it." So I interviewed and got the job and left the Times to go to Spotify. Also a really incredible experience because I was there about 9 months pre-IPO. So
that's
I was there
good
when it was
timing.
Yeah, when the getting was good. We were very, very pampered. It was finally the life of a rock star that I always wanted to have, but didn't have when I was like sleeping on bar floors and suffering to do music. So they were just a great company and treated everyone well. And I was able to really get into a lot of super interesting stuff there. yeah, I mean, worked on all kinds of products. I taught internally at their university. They were just a great company. And that's also where I met Alex. Alex was hired. Alex is my co-founder. He was hired at the same time as I was by our boss. And, you know, we were a pretty small team, and our team was dedicated to Spotify's biggest company bets. So outside of just business as usual, they had 10 bets they were working on. And those bets could be, you know, things as sort of tactical and not really that interesting as like GDPR compliance preparation or IPO preparation.
Yeah, like lucky you.
Well, but they also ranged to like really cool stuff like podcasts. Like podcasts were brand new, and Alex and I both worked on the podcast initiative a lot, and we worked on the blended algorithm, which can match people's tastes into a blended playlist, and we worked on the duo plan. Yeah, so it was great. Like, very cool, very, you know, wide breadth of experience. And Alex and I kind of, we became pretty close at the beginning because our first project was a year in review. And at the time, it was like not a dedicated team. And it was a Dickensian best of times, worst of times experience for us. Like, super, super cool to work on something that great, but just like a total sprint nightmare situation for our quality of life for the first 2 weeks we were there. And so, yeah, that's where we started to get close to each other. And we eventually, I don't know how we started talking about what we wanted to do. I mean, I'd always wanted to start something. I'd kind of built things here or there and built things for startups, but never really knew how to kind of get an idea off the ground. And Alex and I, one day, I think we're just talking about it, and he'd gone to Harvard Business School, and you know, he's like, I want to start something too, and that's also my ambition. And so we just kind of started spending more time together. And when we had the opportunity, we would work on Hack Week projects. So one thing that Spotify does that's pretty cool is they give you a week to just work on whatever you want. And so the first Hack Week project, we used our budget there to do a neural network class in New York. And then we wanted to try to build a Lil Wayne lyrics generator. So we were like trying to ingest all of Lil Wayne's lyrics from the songs.
Oh my gosh, I got you.
A generator. Okay. And this is before generative AI was like really, you know, ready for prime time. So it was more like a fun thing than actual functional thing. And then the next time we got an opportunity to do a Hack Week, we had both worked on Spotify's voice product and in different capacities. And I'd had a little bit of experience with voice because, as I mentioned earlier, I had all these hand problems, which also persisted through my time touring. And they didn't get much better when I was typing on my computer all day. So I'd been working with this small community of people that were working on a sort of semi-open source project to help people who were paralyzed or, you know, had repetitive stress injuries to use their voice to program. And so I was super interested in voice from that, and had a little bit of experience working with some of the older models. And I was almost totally hands-free. People used to make fun of me, like talking to my computer and using my head to track my mouse. And so super interested in that. And Alex had a good experience with the voice team. And so the precursor to Slang was that we did a Hack Week on top of the voice stack at Spotify. And we had one engineer and us two, and we spent the week kind of building out these different functions for the assistant that could, similar to some of the functions that maybe like Alexa or Google would have. But the main difference was that we wanted to build a Spotify specific voice assistant that could plug into like a very nice stereo system rather than something that ships with like a little can speaker. Because the idea is that like people who listen to music and are passionate about it probably have like hi-fi systems they want to listen on. They don't want to like buy a little can speaker that sounds terrible. They want to be immersed in the music, and they want to have the same ability to interact by voice with that system in their homes. And so we threw together a prototype and ended up kind of winning second place in the competition in America, and the head of voice, who's now an advisor to Slang, merged our project with one of the other projects. And that was kind of like a aha moment for us, because we were like, wow, we just spent a week together And we're already like this 20 plus billion dollar company is willing to like take our work and turn it into a real project.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that moment we were like, maybe this is a sign that we can do more and kind of pursue our mutual goals of founding a company one day. Mm-hmm. And you know, from there we started to get more serious. And one thing that we really thought about deeply during that project was, what does the voice assistant future look like? Because at the time there was Google Home, there was Alexa, and there was Siri. And so there were sort of these three kind of big company monolithic voice assistants that, for lack of a better word, were pretty bland and appeal to everybody and no one. And so when we built this prototype at Spotify, we kind of like, we just completely removed any of those barriers in our thinking and made it have a lot of personality. So it would, we use Lil Jon's voice snippets for like when you would get confirmation and you were like, hey, Spotify, and be like, what? And then you would give your request
real
and
personality.
They would use, yeah, it'd be like, okay. And so we had a lot of fun and we were like, what if the future of voice is more like the future of websites had been, like Squarespace had created at the time this business off of giving small businesses and medium-sized businesses control over their web presence and branding in a way that was templatized and easy to use, but tweakable enough to be unique and speak that brand's voice. And so similarly, we were like, okay, we've seen this happen with web. We've seen this happen with mobile. Now
yeah,
it's voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what year are we in now, Gabe?
We are in 2019.
Yeah. Okay. This really is years before Gen AI really emerged onto the scene. So you're already thinking many steps ahead. And can you talk a little bit more about the personality and how that works with a company's brand? Like, are there different options, or how does that work?
Yeah, so happy to talk about that. It's interesting because our thinking has sort of been shifting around on this, and the market expectations have been changing wildly with Gen AI and all the technology surrounding it, including generative voices for text to speech. So our current thinking is a little less tweakable on the text side and a little more tweakable on the audio side. And so the reason for that was we started out with something that was totally customizable, Slang, make it totally your brand voice. But we noticed that it gave people a lot of license to kind of break the experience or create bad experiences that when we looked at the metrics were not like great for their business. And so we realized we needed to just put a little bit more guardrails around the experience. And so we went through a big shift and kind of redid the product and made it a little bit more controlled. There's still places to customize, but the places where you do get to really represent your band, we have a ton of different voices you can choose from, accented voices from all over the world, and very natural sounding voices. So you can kind of choose one that can represent the voice you want to have. We also have the capability to like fine tune someone's voice if they wanted their voice to be a part of the platform. That capability kind of arose over time. And then
that's fantastic. On
top of that, for like my music background, I always had this idea of making these experiences immersive. Like in my mind, this shouldn't feel like a phone call. In the future, at some point, this shouldn't feel like the idea of a phone call should kind of be subsumed by something more immersive. Like if I could get rid of the ringtone and just have it where you press a button and you're talking to the business directly, that would be a dream come true, but that would involve bypassing the legacy telephone technology, which is one of the big headaches we have to deal with. But we wanted to make the experience super immersive. And with my music background, I early on started building some prototypes just to get people excited, where I would compose music. And I at some point worked with a really great composer in Britain And he'd done a lot of video game composition that I loved. And I just reached out to him on a whim. And he was like, I'm between projects, so I'll give you guys a decent rate, because this was when we had no money. And so we built these prototypes that were super immersive and didn't feel like kind of a, you know, like a straitjacket phone call stilted mm-hmm. experience. So we've incorporated that into the product now, where we can have all, we have a background music library. Some of it is written by me and still is every time we have new requests, and you can, that runs in the background continuously behind the caller and the AI voice. And so you can kind of build with the voice and the music a unique branded experience. And we are continuing to look at how to like find the midpoint between like too much control, not enough control, and building more like personality templates where the text will be different. So the ultimate outcome here, which is coming, you know, soon for us, is a mixture of, you can, the knobs you can turn are, you can choose a personality, you can choose a voice, you can choose your music or get some custom music made. And then you can create this experience that is very much unique to your business. So that's kind of how we've evolved our thinking. And the reason why we went with audio first is because there has been some human computer interface research that shows that people respond more to audio cues and voice cues than they do to the actual content or text. So that's how we got to where we are today.
Fantastic. You were talking about how you can have some of these different personalities and even different accents. What I really appreciated was that your natural language processing is really good when it comes to customers who are calling in with different accents, or maybe they're of different ages, and really being able to cut through what might be even more difficult for a human who doesn't have the same cultural experiences to understand, and really measure. So much of what you've done is really measuring that return on investment. And I think to be thoughtful in that way and really inclusive and lead to greater return on investment, because you know, because you're being really good about that. So I thought that was fantastic.
I think that key word that you mentioned is inclusive. That's really what the driving idea was originally behind this, is make this technology more democratized and inclusive for people, so that they don't feel trapped by, you know, again, the big sort of corporate voice assistants, and they can access this technology for themselves. It shouldn't just be available to big companies with multi-billion dollar budgets, or companies, mid-market companies that were paying IVR Nuance multiple millions of dollars a year contracts for their voice assistants. So that is really the crux of it. That's why we named the company Slang. We wanted it to reflect the fact that you should be able to speak to your customers in a way that reflects your values and the language that they're accustomed to, and the style of speaking that they're accustomed to, and the style of speaking you want to have as your brand, rather than just be, you know, only able to access sort of like one monotone, or be kind of swallowed up by the voice assistant ecosystem. Because at the time when we started Slang, there was this idea that Google Assistant and Alexa would eventually just eat up everybody's businesses, and you would talk to this one voice and it would do everything for you in the background. And that's still something that's being bandied around with like the updates to Siri. But, you know, we wanted to see a world where businesses have a lot more control over their lives and can customize the experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Gabe, I'm going to switch gears for us a little bit, because this season we're focusing not only on Fast Company's prestigious list of most innovative companies, but we're also taking a look at upskilling when we talk about the future of work. And I'm hoping you can speak to our listeners a little bit about how your technology supports the upskilling of customers or of staff.
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. So I guess I'll start to answer this more generally. So there's sort of like, you know, there's the dystopian AI future and the utopian AI future. And so for for everybody's emotions, let's spare ourselves the dystopian one and go with the utopian one and assume
that
Slang is,
thank you,
is on that path. So in the utopian vision, AI can take labor away from humans that is repetitive and low value, low skill, and honestly pretty frustrating. So you mentioned earlier on the call that you know the experience of calling a restaurant during a busiest time and having a harried host or, you know, someone else, maybe sometimes a manager trying to back up the host, picking up the phone,
right,
and you know, having to handle putting you on hold or talking to someone in the restaurant at the same time or try to get you off the phone as quickly as possible so they can get back to the diner. And so that is a great example of how we can kind of quote unquote upskill people. So in the utopian vision, like, we are helping restaurants level up their hospitality by removing, one, the need to do these tasks, and two, the frustration that can not only affect the caller, but also the person standing in front of the host at that time too, right? Like, if the host mm-hmm. seems like they're in a bad state, it doesn't create this hospitality experience. And we know that the thing that is most near and dear to our customers' hearts is the experience that guests and diners have when they're coming to spend their money, hard-earned money at a restaurant. And so we really want to support their ability to kind of pull themselves up to a higher level mm-hmm. and reimagine how labor can support the goal of hospitality and experience, rich experiences, even on budgets that, you know, maybe you're not 11 Madison or something, but like, you want to, you aspire to be like that, but you're sort of, you don't have the budgets and you need to really figure out how to optimize your labor so that you can grow your business into something more aspirational. And so I think it's not exactly upskilling, but in a way it is sort of like a philosophical upskill. It's like you now have time back. That's kind of also the billions of minutes saving. Like, what will you do with this time to actually create the vision you had for your business in the first place when you're not dragged into, you know, these kind of like, or sucked under the undertow of these like small little currents that aren't really adding value to your business?
Gabe, I think it absolutely is upskilling, because when you think about it, you're giving customers and those who are working at the restaurants an opportunity to elevate the experience. And so to really focus on what makes us uniquely human, as opposed to answering some of the more routine questions that can be automated and in a nice immersive type experience the way you've built it. So yeah, we're at a time in history where we really should, as humans, be focusing on that, which is more about the connecting with one another. So yeah, I can see how it absolutely is leading to upskilling of just people's skills in general.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. That's generally like my philosophical bent on this whole AI thing, is that like, well, we should use this opportunity to get better as humans, doing what humans do well. And that's, you know, well, maybe not do well, but should do well, which is
should like do well. Said, yes.
connecting with each other, learning to communicate better with each other, and learning to live better lives, human lives, without being pulled into things that frustrate us.
Absolutely. Gabe, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, as a startup, how is Slang.ai ensuring its technology and employees are prepared for concerns over data privacy and other sensitive customer information when using artificial intelligence?
Sure. I know this is obviously a big concern, with the concerns about capitalist movements towards autocracy or capitalist autocracy. But the way we handle this is, one, we're really serious about compliance. So we're SOC 2 compliant. We're working on our GDPR compliance. Alex and I went through Spotify's GDPR compliance and actually worked partially on it. And so I think that's a really unique experience if you haven't worked for a company that operates in environments where regulation is not necessarily seen as a bad thing. Like, it was interesting to be in meetings with our Swedish colleagues, and I'd be like, oh, I can't access this data anymore because of GDPR, and now I have to go through the governance office, and it slows everything down. And you know, they would be like, yeah, that's the point. Like, we're trying to build a world where we don't just like have surveillance of all of our users. We have controls, and like, you shouldn't be able to access that data. There's a lot of interesting learnings interacting with a more kind of socialist democrat country with people who think differently about regulation. And so, yeah, I mean, we kind of are dyed in the wool, like protect our users, people after having that cultural experience. And so we take all kinds of measures to keep the data private internally, so you know, people can't look at it and be compliant with all these compliance regulations as we expand, you know, probably across the pond and other places. So yeah, it's something that we have always had in mind. It's something I've always sort of built from the beginning into the tech stack.
It's so important. And for you and Alex to have had that GDPR training, what a great way to have that background and build it into what you're doing with your company. So something really exciting was recently announced. For those listeners who may not know it, OpenTable is the global leader in restaurant tech. It helps more than 60,000 restaurants worldwide fill 1.7 billion seats a year. And Gabe, I'd really love if you could tell us a little bit about this new partnership that you've launched with OpenAI.
Yeah, so this was sort of a dream come true for us. When we started, we originally didn't start the product in restaurants. We started in e-commerce and then ended up sort of pivoting to restaurants. We hired one of our early salespeople who came from OpenTable, and he was like, oh my God, you guys should be selling this to restaurants. Like, this is going to be great. So once we started seeing all the traction, you know, he and I were very early on, were like, what if we had a partnership with OpenTable one day where we could actually book people and do things end to end without sending links? Because originally we were just like sending a link for the person to self-serve. But you know, Alex and I had always had the vision of making the product fully end to end as much as possible, so that it can actually do something for you rather than like just help you do something for yourself. And so we basically, 4 years before the partnership launched, we kind of started to try to figure out a way to plot a course there. And it feels pretty miraculous, but you know, after 4 years of kind of keeping focus and meeting the right people and building the business and winning, you know, some of the more important customers OpenTable has and their Rolodex over, we ended up launching an official partnership with them last month. And yeah, I mean, it's already going very well, and more than over the moon about launching this partnership. And looking forward to just helping as many of those operators on OpenTable with their phones and communications as we possibly can. But yeah, I mean, I'm super grateful and honored and thankful for the team, the partnerships team at OpenTable and the exec team. They've been really great to work with. So we are looking forward to seeing where that goes.
I mean, it is huge. And so really, really want to congratulate you and your team. What a match made in heaven, really. It is time for us to wrap up our episode, sadly. But Gabe, I would love it if you could maybe share some advice that you would give entrepreneurs like you who, you know, may not think that they have the traditional track to becoming a founder.
Yeah, I think it's not very novel, but I think for me that one of the most important things is just working really hard and trying to be amazing at everything that you do in life, no matter how small. Don't take any job for granted. Everything is a learning opportunity, and a true entrepreneur will see that opportunity in every experience, even if it's seemingly below you or not what you want to be doing. But you know, you have to also keep focus and try to keep plotting a course, because you know the wind will blow the sands around and you'll lose your trail, and you have to kind of rediscover it all the time. For me, it was very non-traditional, and like I said, I'd kind of built things before and felt kind of lost and didn't have partnership or have access to capital and, you know, had different career paths. But just like the Open Table thing, if you start with a, with an idea of where you're going and you kind of, you have to kind of keep directing yourself back. It's more like sailing a ship than it is like driving a car, right? Like you just have to keep going back, tacking through the wind to find your course. And
I like that.
Yeah. If you keep doing that, eventually you'll find something and you have to be open. You know, being a successful entrepreneur is also about like being open and facing harsh realities and looking them in the eye and having a strategy to move through them. So, you know, I think again, like working really, really hard at everything you do, learning as much as you can all the time. Like I've read about very successful CEOs and I'm kind of the same way. Like I read everything I can get my hands on all the time about multiple things because you never know what information is going to help you with your idea or your next idea. And then keeping your eyes on where you want to go and understanding that it's not necessarily going to be a straight shot. And the worst thing you can do if you really want that, the outcome is to kind of give up. And it's okay to give up for a little bit. Like there are definitely times where I was like, this isn't going to happen for me. But, you know, I would always kind of have that inner voice that was like, you've got to do this. You've got to get back to this. Look at all these companies that are successful. Like you had that idea and you didn't execute on it. Like you could be there too. So you kind of have to just believe that you can eventually get there and don't freak out about not being where you need to be at a certain point in time. You can get there eventually. Some of the most successful founders started companies in their 50s. So I think it's just really those elements to me are the most important ones. And there's also luck. I will say that you have to have a lot of luck, but the best defense against luck is persistence.
That is perfect advice. Be a lifelong learner. Do everything you do with passion. Be prepared to tack through the winds and be persistent and open to opportunity so that when luck hits, you're ready for it.
Exactly.
Listeners, Gabe's journey from music to tech entrepreneurship reminds us that innovation often comes from unexpected places. As we've seen with Slang.ai, the future of work is being shaped by those who dare to think differently and bring diverse experiences to the table. Thank you, Gabe.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners. As we wrap up, I encourage our listeners to embrace new technologies and diverse perspectives in their own professional journeys. Thanks, everyone.
You've just listened to the Future Work Playbook. This podcast series is brought to you by Gunderson Dettmer, the world's number one law firm representing venture capital funds and high growth companies. Join Natalie Pierce on our next episode as she and her guests help prepare your organization for the future. Please subscribe to the Future Work Playbook.